This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty. Welcome to episode 20 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes. Back from a week off after my wife and I had a baby, and I just so happened to be off during what might be the biggest story, maybe in sports and pop culture history, with Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce becoming a thing. So I apologize that I don't have an episode prepared on that, but we do have Pablo Torre joining us today. And Pablo, who recently joined Dan Le Batard's Metal Arc Media and launched the podcast Pablo Torre Finds Out. He also still works for ESPN. So if you find yourself at a sports bar or an airport around 5 p.m., there's a good chance that you'll see Pablo on TV there. Pablo, thank you so much for taking some time to come on the podcast today. Is there an episode of Pablo Torre Finds Out about Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce in the works?
I have so much I want to tell you right now. I'll start with your last question. Number one, we have an episode that is absolutely intersecting with the Taylor Swift industrial complex and the Travis Kelce story.
Okay.
That is just a very small tease. It's weird how this story has happened while we've been working on something that absolutely does have to do with it in a way that I cannot reveal. Beyond that, though, I am so sorry that I am not Taylor Swift. I feel like, yes, bringing me in to substitute in for anybody to talk about Taylor Swift is a real disappointment. So I apologize. Also, you just casually mentioning Brandon. Oh, by the way, I just had a kid.
Yeah.
Congratulations, man.
Thank you.
That's the lead here. I want everybody to appreciate that you've buried the lead here.
Thank you. Yeah, we had a baby 2 weeks ago, and we moved into a new house 3 weeks ago. So it's been total whirlwind of emotions, but all good stuff. I do want to just kind of piggyback off the Taylor Swift thing here and just say, like, am I wrong in assuming that there are no limits for a merger like Taylor Swift and the NFL? Like, could this end in Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce eventually living in the White House?
It does feel, I hadn't thought about it till just now, but it does feel like the SEC should be putting a stop to this. Like, you can't have two monopolies join forces in this way. It feels unholy almost. It feels like the algorithm has come to life and is now just actually strangling everything else in its wake.
It's not easy to overshadow anything in the NFL, but like Taylor Swift pulled that off. Her mere presence at a Chiefs game has now dominated radio shows, debate shows. It was discussed again on Monday Night Football last night. Like, usually people just are desperate to get a piece of the NFL, but here's the NFL now playing second fiddle to Taylor Swift's love story. And I don't know how many people there are that would be capable of pulling that off.
I think it's like her and Beyonce, but I even think that right now she ranks ahead. This is a dangerous statement. I think she ranks ahead of Beyonce on the power poll of stardom. And you're right. Like, look, one of my sort of like truisms about sports is that the NFL specifically is like the last remaining monoculture in American life. Right. You know this from covering media. Like, everything is so deeply fractured. Nobody watches or listens to the same thing. Nothing unifies people like the NFL does. And so for the NFL to genuflect, to beg for the table scraps dropped by Taylor Swift, who's not even saying I'm dating Travis Kelce. She's just showing up.
She was just there.
And then she admittedly, she got in the convertible with him after the game. Just that much was enough to remind us all. It was incredibly humbling. I just love the way you framed it. I think you cut to the story here. It's incredibly humbling to realize, as much as we think that the NFL is the monoculture astride a planet Earth, if not American society, for all time, it is just now in perspective as to what really moves the needle.
Yeah.
And it's Taylor Swift deserves every cliche as to Yeah, a five-tool player who has every – yeah, it's just like, yes, her. Number one overall draft pick, Taylor Swift, please.
So while we wait for the now inevitable Taylor Swift episode of Pablo Torre Finds Out, you did have a Donald Trump-related episode of your podcast. And talk about, like, making your presence felt at Meadowlark in a big way. Your first podcast episode there was essentially confronting Dan Le Batard about his past interviews with Donald Trump that he attempted to scrub from the archives. So when was Dan made aware that you were working on that?
Dan was never told in full what we were doing until we sat down to record it. And so Pablo Torre Finds Out, the premise of it had always been sort of twofold. Like, we want to find out in an investigative journalistic sense. But we also wanted to fuck around. For the profanity. But truly, like, part of it is we want to do stupid things seriously and vice versa. And so for me, like, nothing encapsulated that mission statement more than starting my new job, the thing upon which I staked the future of my family, by confronting the co-founder of said company with things that are legitimately humiliating for him. And so Dan didn't know that I had all of this stuff teed up this way. I was going to do it as a confrontation. I was going to do it by essentially diving through, dumpster diving in the end, to your point about, like, he wanted to throw this all out. Like, this was not available online anywhere. Everyone had forgotten about it, which speaks again to just, like, the way that we're overloaded by everything. And so the fact that Dan had interviewed Donald Trump, Dan Le Batard, maybe the foremost opponent of Trump when it comes to just people who can't stop talking about Trump in sports media, the fact that that guy had Donald Trump on as a guest on his show, as a friend of the show, as a call-in guest over 3 years, and that tape had been lost and gone until I exhumed it off of a hard drive in Miami, only to confront Dan with the truth of his past in ways that were, I think, both deeply introspective but also legitimately cringe inducing. All of that is absolutely a dangerous way to start your career somewhere. Yeah.
Were you aware of how much they had spoken in the past? Like, did you have that in memory, that you knew that he had interviewed him multiple times and had him as almost a frequent caller over those few years?
Yeah. So the way I stumbled upon this is where I am also complicit and guilty, is that I showed up to co-host Dan's radio show for the first time in 2015 in person in Miami when it was at ESPN. And that day, we had a call-in guest that turned out to be Donald Trump. And so I interviewed Trump with Dan and Stu Gatz on air on live ESPN radio. And at the time, my question was, like, why are we doing this? And it was not, certainly it was not enough to not do it. But I was informed that actually this happens a lot.
Yeah.
You know, like, Donald Trump's a caller. Donald Trump says he loves Dan's show. Like, there is tape of Donald Trump repeatedly complimenting Dan Le Batard and how much he loves the show. And so ever since that day where Dan sort of said, like, actually he's a call-in guest, I've been obsessed with finding out why, how often, what you guys talk about. Because that episode that I did with Dan, in which Trump was a call-in guest, was the last time he ever appeared on the show, because I think it was like 3 weeks later, 3 or 5 weeks later, Donald Trump declared his candidacy as president of the United States. And then everything was like, oh, this thing, we can't really do this anymore.
Well, and I guess in Dan's defense, he's not alone there. I mean, there's a lot of radio shows. Donald Trump was not hard to find throughout. I mean, in the 80s, 90s, 2000s.
Oh, Stern.
Yeah, right. Think of the amount of times that he was on Howard Stern and the way Stern has kind of, you know, tried to alienate himself from Trump in the years since he declared his candidacy for president as well.
Well, listen, that's part of the introspection here, is that we are not the show. Pablo Torre Finds Out is not a show that is meant to just engage in moral scolding. Like part of why I wanted to do this episode was because I wanted to reckon with how good a guest Donald Trump was.
Yeah.
Like he's good at sports radio.
Yeah. Donald Trump super is kind entertaining. Of like the,
oh, no doubt. He's funny. Like he's Donald Trump for all of the other stuff that is now obvious. I don't even need to say anymore about like caveating why he's, you know, a bad guy, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
The reality is he's an A+ sports radio gas bag. And, yeah. And I loved listening to these tapes in a way that made me think about, oh, this is his superpower. Like if you're running against Donald Trump now, right? The whole point is not, again, if you're strategizing politically, like you should not be in denial about that. You should not deny that Donald Trump is really good at being on camera, being a character, being on TV. Like you almost need to concede at the start of every debate, I would advise at least. Like this guy's going to be a lot more charismatic than me. He's going to be funnier than me. You're going to like him more than you like me. He's going to seem more real. And like, go from there. Like, don't try to compete in that way. We should not be in denial about why Trump got elected. A lot of it is because he is, in fact, the guy on these tapes. And it's compelling. It's good radio.
Yeah. And then similarly, Chris Christie has tried to be that sports radio caller and entertainer, except I'd say he's more of like a C- sports radio gas bag.
Yeah. Chris Christie, by the way, who showed up in the owner's box with Jerry Jones at the Cowboy game. Again, just sort of being like the also ran in the derby of like celebrities in any given news cycle. It's like, yeah, sorry, Taylor Swift took your shine there, buddy.
You've compared the new podcast to a magazine. What magazine do you think is most capable of running with the headline, "Is Russell Wilson an undercover alien running for president of the United States?"
I should make clear that not every episode is about the presidency, but it is about people who are, I think, just like super strange, I don't know, characters who I find like actually interesting on a level of just human nature. So what magazine would run with that? I'd like to think that we're pioneering that magazine right now, Brandon. I don't know if my editors at Sports Illustrated or ESPN the magazine, or certainly the New Yorker or Rolling Stone would all sign off on that headline. But truly, like, it is the reason why I call it a magazine is because what I'm trying to do is something different. I've worked on shows, hosted them, still love appearing on shows that react to the news cycle and try to read people's interest as a way of generating the rundown. So yeah. Like, oh, the Cowboys had a big game. That's obviously A1. First Take's going to lead with that. So old PTI, so old Around the Horn. ESPN Daily, when I hosted it, felt obliged to respond to the biggest things happening in that day in sports. And this show has a magazine sensibility insofar as we're going to give you somewhat of a zag away from other people's zig. You may be thinking about Russell Wilson in some sense because the Broncos just lost by 50 points. You missed that one too, by the way, by caring for your child. The Broncos lost by 50 points to the Dolphins. And my thought was, oh, I don't want to do that story, but I do want to do a story about what it was like to go to college, to be the roommate and the backup quarterback and an attendee of Russell Wilson's first wedding. You know, like, so we got Nate Tice to give us the untold stories about what's it like to go to college with that guy. How do we get into that guy's life? How do we get into his inner circle in a way that sort of provides texture and context? So the point is, the magazine idea is do a story that other people aren't doing, but sort of surprise you with the angle such that even though you didn't know you wanted it, now you're sort of in for the ride.
Are you enjoying the freedom to create whatever you want with Meadowlark Media? For years, Dan talked about wanting freedom from the establishment. And I imagine he's good about giving his employees those same freedoms that he sought.
Yeah, I cannot think of another company, literally anywhere, that would allow me to get away with publishing the episode that we recorded for our first one. Like that was, I tested it immediately, man. Like truly, I tested it immediately. And ever since, and this is both the terror and the genuine thrill of doing this show, is no one's telling me I can't do X or Y or Z. Like there is no heavy editorial hand. There is virtually no bureaucracy. Like Meadowlark was founded by former president of ESPN, John Skipper, of course. But John and Dan, I see them as partners. They're not editorially like saying, don't do this, don't do that. And in fact, like part of my joy is surprising them with what we're doing, you know? And so we get weird, man. That headline you read of the episode title is only one example of just like the stuff that we're finding out about. We want this to be aggressively different because left to my own devices, literally, like me and my phone and my Google Doc coming up with story ideas, it's a psychedelic YouTube channel / audio first magazine that I'm super proud of because it is born in like this just absurd freedom that no one else should have, honestly.
Are you a full-time Meadowlark employee or is it part-time ESPN? Is it 50-50 or...
Yeah. I'm a full-time Meadowlark employee. Full-time. I have a small stake in the knee, but I gave up my Disney healthcare, man. So I appear on Around the Horn and PTI as a freelancer, and I'm so grateful to still do those shows that I love. And I'll do appearances on like Morning Joe on MSNBC now on Mondays. I love gas bagging on TV. That has not gone away. But in terms of like where my actual job is, it's at Meadowlark. That's my home.
So you didn't need to like get approval from ESPN then to be doing a podcast with Meadowlark since you're freelancing with ESPN?
Well, part of the deal, the negotiation was, and this was not guaranteed by any means, was, hey, can I still do these TV appearances, 100 a year on ESPN, while taking my digital self, like the future of my career, honestly, like, you know, I don't know if you've heard about this, Brandon, but the internet's like super important now. as we talk through a computer screen. No, I needed to negotiate that. I needed to negotiate the right to own my digital self and then sell it and partner with Meadowlark to do it. ESPN had to sign off on that. And I am, legitimately, eternally grateful that we worked out a delicate diplomacy that allows me to do both.
So do you think, like, has Stephen A. Smith with his podcast being independent of ESPN, has that helped kind of pave the way for ESPN employees to work at ESPN and then still explore and launch other ventures outside of it?
Yeah, I think it's pretty safe to say. I mean, that's an astute reading of it, right? Like, Stephen A. is the most important person at the company in terms of talent. That seems pretty indisputable. By the way, again, Chris Christie comes up when he has Chris Christie on his podcast to kind of endorse him for president.
Yeah,
I don't want to keep talking about Chris Christie with you, but it is telling. Like, Stephen A. goes on Fox News. He does whatever he wants outside of his ESPN life. Like, on ESPN, you abide by ESPN's rules, but just, I think it's a recognition by ESPN and by Jimmy Pitaro, president of ESPN, of course, that we're living in a world where people have multiple jobs. You know, that's the future of media, is that everyone's sort of like slicing themselves up and apportioning it to different places. And I think it's just the smart, realistic strategy of like, oh, people are going to need to do stuff elsewhere as well as the stuff they do for you.
There has been a sort of recent trend with some conservative voices leaving ESPN, citing censorship and the need for more freedom. And I think we could certainly poke some holes in some of those claims, but I'm curious if you think that Dan is able to ignore party lines at all and maybe sympathize or understand where they're coming from, considering he left ESPN similarly seeking more freedom.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, right? Like, I can't speak for Dan, but I do believe that there are constraints placed when you're on ESPN air. And I think the piece that got reached, or at the very least, the peace of mind that got reached as to why Dan wanted to leave and why others have left, whether it's Sage or whoever else, like, I think people can understandably bristle that when you're on ESPN air, there are different rules, you know? Like, and I don't think there's any real arguing about that. I think that there are always, I would say, a surprising amount of ways to talk about non-sports by talking through sports. And I've made my career at ESPN doing just that. Like, I've done episodes hosting ESPN Daily about China, you know, like the number one, like, bright line, don't cross this thing, ESPN sort of Disney concern, but we did it through the realm of journalism, right? There was a time and place. And so we justified it. We ran it up the flagpole, certainly, but we argued that this is worthy of coverage and they let us do it. And so I think it's just a matter of time and place and setting. Like, and also what I came to make peace with also was, if I want to do my weirdo stories that are going to be like ever more aggressively zagging away from the sort of straight ahead rundown of sports topics, then I probably should leave. And Dan certainly made that call too. And so I do think there is a fellowship among people who maybe want to do more and just weren't satisfied by what the ESPN constraints were. But I also think, I don't know, the idea that any of us are victims because of it. I am across both party lines. I'm always like, I don't know, man, it's a pretty good job.
Right.
And it's just that you know the terms of conditions.
Yeah. I think that's kind of the, I mean, aside from the different views on politics and maybe some social issues, I do think the difference is that like Dan wanted more freedom. He left ESPN. He launched his own platform. He didn't play the victim, as you said. He didn't do a media tour kind of bashing ESPN. Instead, he just quickly legitimized his motives by starting Meadowlark and going independent. But I do still think that there's at least some parallels between Dan, you know, Sage Steele, Allison Williams, Charlie Arnold, at least saying that they, part of the reason they left ESPN is for more freedom.
Look, I think that, and by the way, I'm sure some people are out there like, Dan complains about ESPN all the time. And look, I get it. I get that.
I think it's a little bit different when you're doing it on your own platform than
100%
doing a media tour to get that point across.
Well said. And that's just the nuance that I wanted to just confirm was that like, yeah, the whole idea of like, I was silenced, you know, it's sort of like, what did you want to say? Like, I just want, I guess, specifics and clarity. Like, I would be more empathetic if it was like, oh, I wanted to talk about this topic on this show that I hosted that dealt with such topics. And now I couldn't. And that's why I got to leave. And now that I've left, what am I doing? I think, by the way, that's sort of like the brass tacks of it that you alluded to. It's sort of like, okay, you have your freedom now.
Yeah.
What do you want to say? And those who are actually saying things of substance, whether it's stuff that I agree with entirely or not, I do respect like, hey, you wanted to take your career in that way. All good. Far be it from me to tell someone on the right that like you can't, you know, live your dream of criticizing, I don't know, vaccine mandates or whatever. But I also get why, like, you know, if you're a SportsCenter host, probably not going to be the best place to say it while calling a highlight. You know, like I think having the difference of I host a talk show about culture and sports versus I am hosting SportsCenter. I don't know. I'm not particularly scandalized by the ways in which certain jobs did not contain all of you. Like, I think we've all made peace with that, and you just go elsewhere to find the rest of you.
Speaking of conservative TV personalities, you told a great story on the Press Box podcast with Brian Curtis last year about your first ever television appearance, which actually came on The O'Reilly Factor. What was that like? And like, is that something, were you nervous? Were you hesitant to do it, or just kind of jumped right in?
No, it was as terrifying a thing as I've ever done. Because it was the first TV appearance I had ever made, ever. I cannot stress that enough. Like, I started doing television by climbing in, it felt like, to my television and encountering, you know, Papa Bear Bill O'Reilly, who's like the most absurd caricature of like what a cable news talking giant, literally giant talking head is like. And so, yeah, the backstory briefly is just that I was a fact checker at Sports Illustrated in 2008. It was the Beijing Olympics. Fox News, Bill O'Reilly specifically, wanted someone from Sports Illustrated. And I say someone because it was not me specifically. It was just literally any warm body that they could sit in front of Bill O'Reilly with Sports Illustrated on the chyron, who could essentially be lectured at by Bill O'Reilly about his high school swimming career. He's a swimmer, it turns out, from Long Island. I knew the Long Island part, didn't know the swimming part. And he wanted to lecture me about Michael Phelps. And by me, again, I mean anybody. So I show up because the press person at Sports Illustrated is like, do you want to do this? And I thought to myself, like, okay, so I used to do speech and debate. I was the debate captain in high school, but did not do any of that in college. My sort of like vocal, whatever, performance sort of muscles had atrophied. And I knew nothing about Michael Phelps outside of what I had watched on like NBC, to be perfectly candid. And so it was just like, do I just want to go there and like, I don't know, try to sound like an expert on something? And I was like, you know what? when, and this is just the lesson that I learned that day that sort of carried me through my entire career to this interview with them doing with you today. I just said, fuck it. Like, I should try to do this. When am I going to get the opportunity to do this? I should try and see what it's like. I should find out. Truly, I should find out to live up to the name of the show that it was years and years away from being founded. And I did it, and I learned a lot, Brandon. I learned a lot. I learned about listening face, which is a thing that anybody now knows from Zoom calls, and certainly Stephen A. is a master of, speaking of him. It turns out when you're listening to someone lecture you about Michael Phelps, you may still be on camera, and you shouldn't look like you're crapping your pants, terrified while you're listening. You kind of should nod and stuff and or respond, laugh like a human. Like, that was a real big lesson. But the second lesson I learned was that I need to try this again. You know, like, oh, I didn't drown. I survived it despite that. I survived it. And so truly, like, every other opportunity that came to me from then on, will you appear on CNN to talk about Lawrence Taylor's scandal? Will you go on MSNBC to talk about Tiger Woods? Whatever these sports stories were that would penetrate the cable news cycle, they just knew that I wouldn't drown. So they kept on throwing me out there as just like a random talking head doing cable news hits for $0. And I just kept on saying yes.
Can you kind of measure what the toughest TV appearance of your career has been? Whether it's because of the situation you were thrown into or the topic you were talking about?
You know, oh man, it's a really good question. I don't have PTSD in a specific way from a topic, but I can tell you the most nervous I've been. Certainly, look, Bill O'Reilly was one, but then hosting PTI for the first time. It's just like these moments that feel like I'm inside of the television, like staring at Tony Kornheiser. And saying literally the words like, pardon the interruption, I'm Pablo Torre. And just like the physiological, just like it feels so alien to say the thing. It's the thing that I practiced in my mirror. Like I will say to you very transparently, like preparing to do the first episode of PTI that I ever did was incredibly nerve-wracking to the point where like I was practicing that phrase into the mirror over and over again, like a psychopath. You know, like you just want to say the words and get it started without face planting immediately. And then I blacked out and I don't even remember what else happened. But those shows that I grew up watching that I just held in such sort of daunting regard, both as a fan in PTI's case and also just as like a guy who knew about the institution in O'Reilly's case. I wish I knew what I talked about on that episode, but I just remember Tony Kornheiser definitely made fun of me for looking like I was, you know, 12 years old and had no idea what I was doing, which he was not totally wrong about.
Did you know Kornheiser and Wilbon before you started becoming a guest host on PTI?
Yeah. So no, I knew of them. I remember, actually, it's funny. I don't think I've ever told this story or told Mike this, but there's a photo on my computer from like an NCAA tournament round that I covered, in which I happened upon Mike Wilbon like at the media table like typing away on his laptop like a column, presumably for the Post, Washington Post, and I took a creep shot of him and I was like, Mike Wilbon in the wild. Like, I took the photo, like saved it, sent it to my friends, and recently, because I was like clearing out my hard drive, found it, and I was like, oh my god, this is bizarre that I like was that guy fanboying over this as if he was my Taylor Swift, and now like am his substitute when Kornheiser like needs someone to yell at, you know, on PTI when Mike's, I don't know, on a super yacht with Magic Johnson. Like, that's a weird life that I've stumbled into. But Kornheiser, truly, like, I knew the first time I met him was in the PTI offices in DC. I had by that point like been a part of the Around the Horn family as a panelist. I'd filled in for Reality, which is another, just like filling in for Tony Reality and Around the Horn, probably the hardest thing I've had to do, just because it's a physical job. Like, you're moving around. His energy level is unparalleled in, I would say, like the human race. You're sort of like doing all of these things with your hands. Really, really hard to do.
Yeah, there's a unique cadence to it.
And it's just so, you can't, and to his credit, Reality's credit, brief digression, like trying to do Around the Horn with your own voice feels perverted. It's sort of like, why is, you can't do this without being Tony Reale. Like, how are you even trying to do this? It felt ridiculous. So you end up imitating Reale, which is the worst of all worlds because no one is him in that way. But anyway, I was imitating Reale and failing to succeed in the DC offices of PTI and around the horn. And I just remember like meeting Kornheiser because I would get pulled in occasionally to be a substitute stat boy for Reale. Because Stat Boy, of course, for people who've watched the show for a long time, like that was a key part of PTI. It ended when Reale decided to take Around the Horn to New York. And God bless him for doing it. But that's when Stat Boy ended. He became a man. He had his bar mitzvah, so to speak. And me meeting Kornheiser in the offices as substitute Stat Boy, I don't think he knew who I was at all. In fact, the running joke was, and this is from Kornheiser and from Eric Rideholm, the producer of PTI, was Tony will only co-host PTI with you if you spray paint your hair gray so that you look older. And I don't think that was a joke. Like, I think Tony actually was saying to everybody, he looks too young. It makes me look too old. I'm never going to do this. And so that was my introduction to him. And then years later, I sort of got older, grew terrible facial hair, and convinced him that I could be his colleague instead of just his sort of like, you know, stat infant, as it were. So yeah, that's how I got to know him.
But you never had to dye your hair.
No, now I just am waiting for mortality to actually naturally do the thing that Kornheiser demanded. But no, I held out on. I'm very proud of holding out on that part.
Dan Le Batard hates sports debate television. You have sort of embraced it in your career. Is debate TV culture good for sports, or is there a toxicity to it?
Certainly there's a toxicity to it, if done badly. Like everything, I think there are ways to do it well and ways to do it badly. And I'm not even like shading First Take when I say that. I am absolutely clicking on some viral First Take content as soon as it comes across my timeline, right? And so the proof is in the pudding in that way. But I also think for the shows that I do and that I continue to love doing, you know, it's sort of like there are good directors and bad directors. There are good movies and bad movies. Like there are good comedies and bad comedies. Some are ridiculous. Others sort of make you think as well. And so for me, the toxicity of sports debate culture cannot be divorced from the influence of PTI. I just want to be honest about that. Like without PTI, by the way, PTI infected cable news. Like let's blame Rideholm and Kornheiser and me, I guess, by proxy for that too. Like there was never a topic bar and clocks and guys yelling in the way that PTI sort of proved as proof of concept could successfully be executed. But when it comes to like what's bad about sports debate culture that I sort of cringe at, I don't want to just name the names that I'm imagining when I imagine bad sports debate, but I do think that there is an art to being a gas bag, and that I don't consider myself nearly as good as the best gas bags, but I do consider myself somebody who, can explain why they find something interesting and have opinions that are maybe going to provoke some thoughts. And so I love sports debate culture in ways that Le Batard will never admit to, but Le Batard used to do PTI, man. He's a total hypocrite. You know, like he used to do Highly Questionable. Like again, you can do weird sports debate. You could do sports debate that parodies sports debate. Well, let's also be honest. Like we're also drinking from the same trough of, you know, did the Cowboys choke? You know, I'm not above that question when it comes to being on ESPN.
Have you had much interaction with Stephen A. during your 10 plus years at ESPN?
I used to see him in the Seaport all the time when I was hosting High Noon, and we would be coming out of him. He was our First Take. And what a strange sentence. First Take was my lead in for 2 years. And so I used to see Stephen A. in the makeup room. I remember going to Stephen A. and this was like a very again, I'm only remembering this now. I remember the day I got you know this term. What's the term? Is it, what's the scan of your baby when you see them and like you can see their face? Like, what's that called? It's
ultrasound.
Sonogram. Ultrasound. Sonogram. Yes. Sonogram. Yeah. One of those.
Yeah.
So I have the photo my wife took of her sonogram. And you see my daughter's face, and I'm just like, yeah. Again, as I'm sure you felt, you know, very recently, I was just sort of in awe of this sort of out of body experience. And I was just like wandering around showing this to people. And I walk into the makeup room and I just see Stephen A there. And I'm like, Stephen A, check out my daughter. I just got this sonogram or this ultrasound. And he just looks at me and he just very sternly, meaningfully tells me that you will never love anything as much as you love your daughter. You're going to kill someone if that's what it takes to defend them. And I was like, all right, cool. I'm gonna show this to Max now, see how that goes. But no, I mean, like he played along with like the Halloween episodes we did and like the April Fool's episodes we did. I had him yell, stay off the weed at me in one like sketch we did. Stephen A has always been like down for the joke. And that's what I want to just sort of briefly point out about him. For as much as he is like a parody of our idea of like a sports gas bag, he's so deeply theatrically talented. And he has a sense of humor about himself. Like, he is down to be made fun of in ways that I think he would never explicitly say because it kind of ruins the joke. But if you just see what he's willing to do, it's clear that it's true. And I think that's just so key to like the job that he does.
As a journalist and an entertainer yourself, do you think Stephen A. Smith does a good job of both on First Take and also like does he almost get upheld to an unfair journalistic standard at times by people who might not recognize that First Take is entertainment first?
Yeah. I mean, look, Stephen A., every time I've heard him defend his resume, he lists every stop on his resume in which he was a journalist. And I think it's possible to practice journalism without being a journalist. I think the difference is, you know, far be it for me to lecture someone as if I teach at the Columbia School of Journalism or whatever. But for me, I think he has journalistic tendencies, but clearly works in the realm of entertainment first and foremost. Yeah. You know, like I think the idea of like, I'm going to pick a fight or I'm going to argue back and forth and criticize this guy I don't know is not something an objective journalist would do, but it is something that a talk show host would, an entertainer would. And I think the confusion, and this is an understandable confusion, man, it's when you do both and those lines are blurred, It's you get to be everything for better and for worse. You get to be criticized for crossing lines journalistically, and you get to claim that actually look at my phone. I got this text from Michael Jordan. Look at my phone. I was talking to this head coach, you know? And so being plugged in, journalistic tendency, is added value. He's really, really good at that. At the same time, he's going to horrify professors of journalism who say that, of course, he is conflicted and is motivated by things that are not the pursuit of truth, but the value, entertainment value of the show. And in my own way, perpetually, I reckon with this too. I mean, in my own way, far smaller, I'm always making that calculation of like, am I going too far here? You know, I think part of being a journalist, Brandon, just to wrap up my little hobby horse I'm on, is just, it does mean not saying everything. And so the question of like, what am I going to report and say? You need to make sure that you have rigorously interrogated yourself as well as your source. You know, did I do enough to bring this onto the record? And being a journalist means that you don't say everything. You don't disclose everything. And I can't speak for Stephen A's standards, but I try to take those standards seriously because I'm self-conscious about how I do it too.
How did you feel when you landed the opportunity to headline a show on ESPN? And of course, I'm talking about High Noon with Bomani Jones.
Yeah, it was, I mean, a dream, just beyond my expectations. I'm endlessly, eternally grateful to Bo for like having faith that I would work as his partner. You know, like that guy, as fast a brain as I've ever worked with, he was the bigger star when High Noon was the show. And so he trusted me in a way that I can never fully repay, truly. And to work with Rideholm on a show was all, I mean, look, Rideholm, Eric, is one of my closest friends in the world still. And so for us to all work together was something that I look upon with such nostalgia and fondness, even if it didn't end the way that, you know, we wanted it to, even though there were changes along the way. I think that's something that I'm so glad I did. I found out what it was like, and I'm very glad I did.
Why didn't the show last, in your opinion?
Oh, I mean, look, multivariate equation.
Was it
right?
Given enough of an opportunity as a live show before it went to being a pre-recorded show?
Yeah, so just as the standard caveat is, I have no ill will towards ESPN for making this decision. I don't want to make it seem like I'm losing sleep over this. I do think the best version of the show was an hour live. It was the best way for both of us to be our best selves and build chemistry and sort of show off our processing sort of stories in real time, and the unpredictability of the digressions we would go on. And I think we were all fully sort of in on that being the premise. But then, of course, like, for various reasons, because SportsCenter wanted that slot or earned that slot because of ratings, and because the 4 p.m. happy hour sort of like extension ended up being where we got moved to the 30-minute format. Yeah. That's where I think immediately just the crunch affected us in terms of just like what the show was, what we each individually were trying to be in that context. And then also, I think, to be blunt, like in retrospect, like High Noon was an amazing podcast / digital video show that would have found footing digitally in a way that I think would have kept it alive for who knows how long, versus playing the game of, you know, we have a lead in that's First Take, and now we're sort of clinging to the linear television audience, the Nielsen box. Like, I think in that way, the internet was probably the best fit for us, even though ESPN, again, grateful for it, is a television company first. And I totally get why that's where, and I wanted that, by the way. I wanted a TV show. There was prestige there. But I think in retrospect, there's no question that our sensibilities were more internet sensibilities, and were ahead of their time, at least in that very specific way.
Do you think you would have, it would have been successful if it was pre-recorded and on the internet, or would you have wanted it to be live if it were to be on the internet?
Yeah, you know, live is such a interesting condition to play the game by, because without a net, I find that sort of your brain activates more. I remember talking to Keith Olbermann about this. Keith Olbermann famously like could only really be his peak self when live, and that doing tape shows just it was just not ever the same for him. And for us, I think live would have been better. Streaming live would have been better. Yeah. Than taped, no question, just because of all of that stuff. But I also think the bigger differentiator was just the ability for young people to go find it, you know, at 12 p.m. or 4 p.m. Eastern time. You know, I just think we have a better shot at reaching audience over the internet than we do people who might be in front of a Nielsen household, you know, connected television during the day.
Is it hard to keep working for the same company after they cancel your show? Like, did you ever feel inclined to leave ESPN out of spite after High Noon ended?
No. I mean, this is just the truth is that I like working for ESPN has changed my life. Like, I'm not ready to get off the television in that way. It's why I carved it out for my current deal. You know, even when I had this exciting opportunity to like become a three-dimensional version of myself with Meadowlark, certainly there was hurt, you know.
Yeah.
Let's be blunt about that, too. There was hurt there. Your pride is damaged. But at the same time, you sort of get that this is the business, and you at a certain point realize, but the good news is I get to still do Around the Horn, get to still do PTI, get to still do Highly Questionable. At that point, Highly Questionable was still around. Dan was still working for ESPN. Like, I had a fallback that was unusual in that I got to still work with my friends. And then I got the opportunity just to prove the point of like hosting ESPN Daily for 2.5 years or whatever it was in the end. And that was wildly fulfilling. And I don't do what I do now without that. And so, yes, some bitterness, because I'm a flawed meat sack of a human being, but the opportunities I was given afterwards, yeah, are tremendous, man. Like I can't complain about that. I would be a total hypocrite if I did.
Was High Noon at all hurt by being branded as like a smart sports show? Like, did it almost give the vibe that it was going to be too analytical or preachy, which by the way, like it was not, that's not what the show was, but I feel like people leaned into the smart thing. And I wonder if that gave some misconceptions about what the show actually was.
I'm sure it mattered, right? Because on High Noon, what we did was mostly laugh and do lots of silly things. I mean, we did weird cold opens. We did weird bits. We did stories that were absurd. We talked about Nathan Peterman repeatedly. Like, we were just doing stuff that I think made us think and made us laugh. Smart and funny is always what I'm going for, even still today with the show that I do now. But I do think that framing and branding is so important, right? Like, if we in any way, and this is just me playing along with the hypothetical post, if we were branded as the egghead smart guys who scolded you about how you're dumb and how you didn't have the right thoughts and you were immoral for rooting for this thing over the other thing, that sucks. Like, I never want to be that. And I get why in Twitter, in sort of Twitter parlance, like, to be on the left and to be smart means that you're preachy, and that means that you're like trying to serve people vegetables inside of this vending machine that they just want candy, you know, out of, right? And so to me, smart is dangerous, even though smart is always what is at the core of me aspirationally, because what I want to prove is that it's actually kind of fun to find stuff out that you didn't know before. And if that means melting some cheese on your broccoli, I will go to that length to do it. But I don't want to be known as broccoli guy. That fucking sucks. Yeah.
You are smart. You went to Harvard. You were going to go to law school. You ended up, as you said earlier, being a fact checker at Sports Illustrated instead. Was there ever a moment of like wondering if you were almost doing yourself a disservice by not doing something more? Like, was sports going to be fulfilling enough?
Yeah. I mean, my parents have asked me for years, like, you're not going to go to grad school? Like, why did we come to America? If you're going to just like, you know, dick around doing sports stuff. That was earlier on than recently,
yeah.
admittedly, but certainly I just had an episode of my podcast of Pablo Torre Finds Out where I talked to Dominique Foxworth, who went to Harvard Business School, ran the Players Union, you know, played in the NFL, about like how it is we both wound up doing this job, sports media. And what we both settled on, despite our neuroses and our inferiority complexes and our insecurities about, could we have done, and I still want Dominique to like run for Senate at some point, by the way. If what could we have done, is sort of this tantalizing idea when we are, I think, facing like real world, we're talking about real world problems. And I'm like, oh, the guy who's tasked with solving this, though, I went to school with, I know that guy. You know, like, I was in a class with that guy, and that guy sucks. Why am I not like trying to help this problem? You know, why am I not trying to solve the issue of our broken American political system? And I hate to always come back to politics here, but it's always just the most obvious thing when it comes to like, I went to a school that produces presidential candidates.
Yeah.
I went to school with Vivek Ramaswamy, and now I'm watching him like try to con America into electing him president. And I'm like, as much as I complain about that rightfully, I also know in the back of my head that like the best counter to him is to do something about it yourself. And so I'm not going to do that because running for president is psycho shit. But I am definitely aware of the ways in which I need to make sure that what I do is meaningful. And sports media to me is meaningful. It is, unapologetically. Sports is meaningful to me unapologetically, because inside of those words, sports and media, you can talk about everything. Like, that's kind of the premise of the show that I do, is it's a show for people who love sports, also a show for people who don't know or care or even like sports, because inside of sports, we can do everything. We can do every section of the newspaper inside of sports. And that's what was so liberating to me as a fact checker at Sports Illustrated, was realizing, oh my God, this is not limiting. This is quietly like a hack. I can quietly do everything inside of this. I've done stories about business, about religion, obviously politics, race, smart and stupid, highbrow and lowbrow. I like to laugh at dumb things, but I also like to challenge myself intellectually. And sports has never felt limited in that way. It's felt the opposite. And that's why I ultimately sleep well at night, is because I have convinced myself that I am actually doing something that has meaning.
I had a really hard time accepting Aaron Rodgers getting hurt a couple of weeks ago. So I started going through some of the gut punches that I've taken as a sports fan over the years. One of them I think was Jeremy Lin signing with the Houston Rockets.
Oh,
to go from out dueling Kobe Bryant in February to getting hurt in March of that year, and then leaving New York altogether a couple months later, it was so abrupt and surprising. And I think like Knick fans thought he was going to be here for a decade, and then he was gone. Yeah. But those couple of weeks in February 2012 contributed to some of my best memories as a Knicks fan. How was it for you?
Yes.
Getting put on the Jeremy Lin beat for Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, I mean, that story is the most, I've talked about a lot of out-of-body surrealistic things that I have like lucked into covering and doing. That's probably number one overall, like in my power poll. I'm Asian American. I went to Harvard. I covered him for Sports Illustrated when he was a senior in school, and knew his parents, followed him, was texting him when he got picked up by the Knicks, you know, had no idea about any of this. And then for Sports Illustrated, I end up writing these two straight cover stories about him on Deadline, competing against like Frank Isola and like New York tabloid writers who had no idea who I was at the time. And that story, so A, number one, Jeremy Lin dropping 38 at the Garden against the Lakers in 20, you know, in that year. Gosh, it was the greatest sporting event I've ever seen in public, in person. The 2012 season was the most surreal thing I've ever covered. And so I was the guy, incidentally, who broke, you know, heartbreakingly, again, this is where I'm mindful of, like, I'm also a little conflicted here. Shout out to anybody who has rooted for a team while also covering a team. It's really difficult. But I was the one who wrote the story, who broke the story that he was signing with the Rockets.
Yeah.
I was on the phone with him and his agents that night, and I was shocked. And the reason why being that, again, I won't relitigate it with you here, but like the Knicks told him, like, go find your market. He found a market. He found a bidder. The Rockets put a poison pill balloon thing into his contract, so they got paid a lot more than the Knicks were comfortable paying. And that was it. And the happiest, I grew up a Knicks fan, by the way, I should say that. I'm from New York natively, grew up in Manhattan, yep, like blocks away from MSG. So all of this, it was as beautiful on the front end as it was a waste on the back end to me. And never really have gotten over that one. That's like the ultimate, like counterfactual alternate history is Jeremy Lin doesn't hurt his knee.
Yeah.
The Knicks keep him, which they should have done anyway. And he finally gets a chance to like prove that he wasn't just 2 weeks in 2012.
What did covering Jeremy Lin do for your career and even eventually getting to ESPN?
It was huge. I mean, it proved to me that I could write on Deadline, that I was qualified to cover like the biggest story in the world, even though it was so specific and personal to me that it was obviously like the roulette wheel smiling upon my existence, right? Luck was so profoundly important, but also I was given a challenge and I pulled it off and my editors liked it. And that was incredibly gratifying. But then my next editors liked it. That was the bigger thing, right? Was that ESPN basically, that was like the last, that was a tipping point towards me getting a job offer. They like had seen that work. They knew that I could hang, you know, in that way. And so, yeah, I told Jeremy this, like I owe him in a way that is again, journalistically conflicted, but covering him without that, I don't know if I'm talking to you today. Yeah, I just don't.
Had Linsanity continued, like had it gone on to be a 10-year run in New York, and obviously this is a big hypothetical, but do you think that you would have continued to cover it, and could you have almost used it to help foster a career as an NBA reporter, like similarly to the way Brian Windhorst was attached to LeBron James earlier in his career.
It's so funny, man. I had never thought about that. But yeah, like I definitely would have tried to do that. I was trying to write a book with Jeremy and he said no to me, by the way. Like I get why, because he was the most sort of like sought after athlete on the planet at the time. I was clearly too thirsty. I was trying to overstep in the way that I feel like, you know, a little cringe about now. But I was enterprising enough to try and make sure that this opportunity in my career did not go to waste. And so, yeah, by that logic, I definitely would have tried to become the Brian Windhorst to Jeremy Lin's LeBron James, as pathetic as that would have been for everybody involved. Yeah, I would have made the NBA my beat. I always loved the NBA more than anything else. Wrote about it, covered it at ESPN for the magazine. But I would have gone all in on like Linsanity as an industrial complex. And it would have been very disappointing for everybody, I think, in the end. Yeah.
What sports content did you watch and or listen to when you were growing up in New York? Were you a WFAN listener ever?
You know, sports radio, I wasn't a sports radio guy growing up, even though I certainly knew Mike and the Mad Dog because I was friends with sports. I did not have a commute on the way to school. I was always like a subway ride away or walking distance, depending on grade school or high school. But my friends from Long Island, from Queens, from Jersey, like, of course, like I through osmosis, I learned about Chris Russo and Mike Francesa, but was not like a super fan listener of theirs. What I was doing, though, was, I mean, God, I was like, to fit the caricature of like a stat nerd. I was the kid who was like watching games, who was like writing down stats on his own, like little notebook, keeping track of stuff. The Dream Team in 92, I was 7 years old. That was like this giant drug. Michael Jordan's prime. I was coming of age when he was playing the Knicks. That was a huge thing. I was an altar server. I was raised born Catholic. I was an altar server. The priest at my church was the chaplain of the New York Yankees. So like I got, you know, I was obsessed with the Yankees before then, even more so after that. My dad took me to like Big East games at MSG, even though he wasn't like a huge sports knowledge guy. He like loved sports and like took me along, went to Yankee games, luckily. So I was definitely a New York sports, weirdo who was just sort of like I'm just now cringing at like all of the ways in which I was like, I had a binder of Michael Jordan trading cards that a kid stole from me at the playground. That was, I just remembered now in a sort of Vietnam flashback, which is very disturbing.
Another gut punch.
Yes. I can, my daughter's tuition might be in that binder for all I know. But I collected cards. I collected trading cards. You know, I was like, all of that stuff. I subscribed to Beckett Basketball Monthly as if like I was ever going to do anything with these cards. They're still like my mom's house, you know, like I was definitely nerding out in all of the ways around sports fandom.
Maybe this is hard to answer just because Meadowlark is so new, your current venture, but what else do you want to do in your career? What do you aspire to do? You're still very young, especially in terms of sports media personalities. You don't have gray hair yet. What are your career goals or aspirations, whether in or out of sports?
Yeah. I mean, the show that I'm doing now that I've built, that is graying me, incidentally, I want this show to last for a long ass time. Like I want it to be an institution unto itself. The PTI show and Around the Horn, that stuff has existed for two decades. Like my goal is to make something that lasts. I am that ambitious truly when it comes to like, I believe in this thing. I want this to be my home. I built it to contain all aspects of me. For instance, like even just the construction of the show, once a week is a deep dive, magazine style, like the articles I used to write. Once a week is a talk show, me and two friends, like highly questionable, like the ride home shows that I've hosted and still continue to do. The third show a week is a one-on-one conversation because I like interviews. I like interviewing. And so I built this show to contain every part of me. And I want to keep doing it because I just have loved doing it, 1 month in. As crazy as it is to sort of declare any sort of definitiveness around anything that's only a month old, right? As all parents can relate to. You sort of still feel anxious, but you're hoping that you're as happy now as you will be, you know, 10 years from now. So I relate to all of that. But also, like, as long as TV exists, yeah, I love doing it, man. I'm not above it. I love it. Like, doing Morning Joe on Mondays with Joe Scarborough, in which we yell takes at each other, is endlessly amusing to me. Hearing Joe Scarborough say the words Meadowlark Media when introducing me is surreal and makes me laugh, because what a world. And as long as PTI and Around the Horn are still going to be on television, I want to do them. And so I am lucky enough to say, Brandon, that what I want to do long term is a lot like what I'm doing now, God willing. And it's just on me, I guess, to not fuck it up.
Pablo, you were awesome. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Congratulations, man.
Thank you.
Again, I don't want to bury the lead here. that's incredibly exciting. And enjoy the sleeplessness. Enjoy the gray hairs, I should say.
Thank you. That is Pablo Torre. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe to this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.